Inside Utah Politics, trouble at the town hall. Congresswoman Celeste Molloy joins Inside Utah Politics to answer the constituent questions drowned out by a raucous crowd. Plus, the push to overturn Utah's new union law has arrived. How union members are making their case in the time that they have.
Talk to people in Hollywood. I've had conversations. They laughed when they found out Sundance was even considering leaving. They couldn't believe it.
And Governor Spencer Cox's monthly press conference. Hear his thoughts on the report that Sundance could be leaving and the push to wind down the Department of Education.
You're listening to Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ehrens.
Well, thanks for joining us. I am Lindsay Ehrens. Let's go inside Utah politics. We begin our program with a heated town hall at the University of Utah. Representative Celeste Molloy and Mike Kennedy had hoped to show Utah can have tough conversations the right way, but they were met by a hostile crowd. Yeah, that was the scene there. Well, it made for quite the spectacle, with some members of the crowd threatening to be escorted out. Many of the burning questions Utah had for their federal delegation got lost in the noise.
Things are moving fast, and things are getting cut, and things are getting missed, and mistakes are being made, and there's no oversight. And I want to know, at what point are we going to actually do that? And that question was not answered tonight.
I am just distressed by the flaunting of the rule of law. I'm distressed by concerns now that the judiciary may not be listened to and honored.
Well, to set those questions, getting answers, I'm joined today by Utah Congresswoman Celeste Molloy. Representative, thank you so much. Welcome to Inside Politics. And first and foremost, I want to get your reaction to what happened last night. You said yourself on the onset you wanted to show that Utahns can have these tough conversations. What did that reaction say to you about our current political climate?
I think there were people there who aren't ready to have the tough conversations yet. They're mad. They want us to know they're mad. They wanted to be heard, but they weren't ready to listen yet. And it wasn't the whole crowd. There were people there who were trying to listen. There were people there who were engaging and asking questions. I still think in Utah we can have the tough conversations. I welcome those conversations, but it's tough to answer questions when the whole time you're talking, people are screaming over the top of you. And I feel like that kind of goes without saying, except that that's what happened last night. We were there. We were willing to go to Salt Lake County, to the University of Utah, and to talk to a large crowd of people who were obviously not very happy. And I think we'd have had a much better conversation if people had listened to the answers, even if they didn't like the answers. I'm not naive enough to think everybody there was going to walk out happy, but it would have been a better conversation if we had been able to talk.
It seemed to go wrong as soon as you said that you weren't willing to impeach Donald Trump over some of the decisions that he's making, a potential breaking of federal law here or defying a court order for a judge. Just talk to me about why you feel that way. And what is the consequence, if I can continue, what is the consequence for some of the things that he's doing? How does Congress hold him accountable?
Yeah, so the base assumption there was that there have been impeachable offenses committed, which I disagree with. I don't think he's done anything impeachable. And what I would have liked to have talked to that crowd about, but didn't get a chance last night, is that Donald Trump just won the popular vote, and he won all of the swing states. Why did he win? Because the majority of people want something different. They want change. He's moving quickly. It's making people nervous. And if he breaks the law, we have the courts and Congress to help bring it back into balance. But it has been 2 months. Last night was the 2-month anniversary of inauguration, and there's a crowd already asking Republican members of Congress when we're going to impeach a Republican president. I think that was definitely premature and not necessarily a good faith question. I would have rather talk about what they think is happening that's wrong, and we could have gone through those things instead of starting at the baseline assumption that the Constitution has been shredded, the laws have been broken, and when are we going to impeach the president?
Okay, so a lot of this really seemed to center around Elon Musk, the Department of Government Efficiency. It seemed to be top of mind for much of the crowd. They were concerned about the guardrails for his mandate to cut government spending. Can you speak to your views on DOGE and Congress's role in cutting spending? How do we do that? Because I feel like if the shoe was on the other foot and this was a Democratic administration having an unelected person like Elon Musk coming into doing that. Don't you think Republicans would be pushing back on that?
Sure, we'd be pushing back on it. I would hope we would listen to the answers at a town hall, though. Elon Musk is helping Trump accomplish the goals that President Trump promised he would reach on the campaign trail. So he's using him as a consultant. Elon Musk is looking under the hood and saying, this is what's working, this is what isn't. Here's where we have efficiencies and inefficiencies. He has to hand that information off to somebody in the executive branch. They have to make the decisions. And that's the part I think people are unduly upset about, because they're not getting good information. I mean, I see the headlines too. Elon Musk fires people. Elon Musk slashes budgets. But really, Elon Musk is working with the elected president to do that. And that is exactly what the president said he was going to do on the campaign trail. So the question is,
what's the tone? Excuse me. What is the tone between them? Because is it he says jump and the president says how high? Like, take us inside that. Because I think, to your point, we are seeing headlines like that. And you're saying he doesn't have the ability to fire anyone or lay off people. But someone is making those decisions after it's suggested.
Yeah. And those people are part of the executive branch. I'm not in the room to tell you what the tone is when they talk to each other. But I do know that Donald Trump said he was going to cut waste, fraud, and abuse in the government. And one of the points that is often missed in this conversation is that he's cutting waste, fraud, and abuse in the executive branch. He's the head of the executive branch. He's taking a look at his own branch and saying, where are we inefficient? Where can we get better? And they're moving quickly. And when you move that quickly, you're going to learn some things. You're going to find that some of the things you thought were a good idea aren't. And they've already shown that they're willing to back up on some of those things when they realize it's not working. So what I would have liked to have told people last night is watch the process play out for a little bit. It's only been 60 days, and we've already had some decisions walk back because they turned out not to be the best method to get at the goal they stated. So before we start talking about impeachment, lose the ability to talk to each other as Americans, let's watch our institutions work. We have a president who was elected with a mandate. He's working to enact that mandate. The courts are doing their job, and Congress is doing its job. We move slower than the executive branch.
Perhaps some of the frustration last night maybe came from folks who are scared, folks who are worried about their federal jobs. We have IRS workers here in Utah. We have federal workers at our national parks. Perhaps, you know, these layoffs that are happening with the executive branch really impact Utahns. What is the right solution in your mind, and how we cut this government spending, but how we run our national parks, how we run our IRS, how we run all the other things that the federal government does for us, and how it impacts Utah?
So the right solution in my mind is that we look at what's happening in these agencies and find the inefficiencies and eliminate those. And I've said this over and over because it's true, and I think people need to hear people in my position say it. It's going to be painful to get the government to the right size. When we have a bloated government and we have to cut things back, real people are part of those cuts. Real families are impacted when we eliminate government jobs. Real organizations are impacted if we stop sending federal dollars out to programs that used to get federal dollars. But we can't keep going the way we've been going. We're headed towards a fiscal cliff. We're $37 trillion in debt. We have to make tough choices. And I'm very willing to stand there and acknowledge that when we make tough choices, it has real-world consequences. And I think you're right. I think people show up angry because they're feeling those real world consequences. And that is a real and legitimate thing for us to be engaging in on the political stage. That we're not, when we're looking at a budget, we're still talking about Americans who are dependent on that budget. And a lot of the fear is about entitlement programs. We're trying to be very careful with what we do to entitlement programs for the same reason. Real people are dependent on them.
In our last just couple of seconds, Representative Malloy, how will you push back on the administration when they cross a line, when they defy court orders, when they do something that you see is out of line with checks and balances, whether it's with the judiciary? What is your role there, and how do you do it?
So the first thing I'll do is pick up the phone and call them and tell them that I think they're out of line, give them a chance to fix it. The other thing I can do as a member of the Appropriations Committee is control the purse strings. And everybody keeps asking, why aren't we using the purse strings to control this? It's only been 60 days. We cannot pass an appropriations bill in 60 days. but we're working on FY26 appropriations right now.
Representative Congresswoman Malloy, thank you so much for taking the time to clear all this up, to talk to us about that raucous town hall last night. We understand it must have been frustrating, but clearly some anger from constituents who feel like they're not being heard. So we appreciate your time to come and do this. Still ahead on Inside Utah Politics, Utah's new union law faces a challenge. We meet the organizers behind the push to put the question to voters. Stay with us. Well, the Utah Education Association and its fellow unions are 1 week into their signature gathering campaign for a referendum to repeal HB 267. This is the bill signed into law by the governor just over a month ago. It bans public sector labor unions from collectively bargaining for their employees. Now, legislative leaders have held firm against pushback, saying their goal is to protect the two-thirds of teachers who are not union members or who do not want to be.
One of the biggest things you heard from teachers that were part of the union that didn't necessarily want to be is they felt like they had to be able to be protected.
Well, joining me now to share the union's perspective, Greg Burrow, executive director of the Utah School Employees Association. They represent school bus drivers, school support staff, folks like that, as well as Angel Weiss, who's a Salt Lake County employee with the recorder's office and a member of one of the unions who's joined the referendum effort. Greg, Angel, thank you for being here. I appreciate it. So, Greg, just kind of respond there to what the House Speaker said, essentially that people who are not members of the union feel forced to join certain unions. And he did mention specifically the teachers' union there.
Yeah. I think that we first need to realize that Utah is a right-to-work state, so no one's forced to be a part of the unions or associations. We represent members and non-members alike when there's advocacy cases, and we also negotiate a contract for all members and non-members, and so they, without paying dues, they are also receiving the collective bargaining benefits that we all negotiate.
So let's take it back a little bit to the legislative session, just kind of rehash for our voters how we got here, or for our viewers rather, how we got here. There was a compromise on the table for a bill that would have allowed some version of collective bargaining, and those negotiations fell apart. From your perspective, why did that happen?
Yeah, I think it was very frustrating. So House Bill 267 sub 3 allowed for collective bargaining with union recertification every 5 years. A large portion of the public sector unions representing over 40,000 members took a neutral stance on version sub 2 and 3.
Mm-hmm. The compromise.
The compromise bills.
Right.
And we in writing said that we took a neutral position on sub 3. And we met along with UEA, UPEA, which is the Public Employees Association, USEA, the firefighters, all took a neutral position. And as part of that, sub one was on the Senate floor. Mm-hmm. And there was frustration, I think, from the legislators and the senators that they were still receiving opposition emails.
Yeah, in fact, Jordan Tusher, Representative Jordan Tusher, who ran this bill, told me that some of the unions were acting in bad faith. And essentially, they got to neutral with some groups, but other groups were going around and there and opposing the bill.
I would push back on that. I think that sub one was on the Senate floor for a week, even after we took a neutral stance and we were told that it was going to be sub three, that what House Bill 267 sub three that would be negotiated on the Senate floor. Even when it came to Senate negotiations, sub three never came up. It was always sub one. So I think that...
Well, they paused voting on sub one, right, to give the unions time to review the compromise and to get to a neutral position, but ultimately ran the first substitute, you're saying, which was the original just ban collective bargaining.
Correct.
So if they had the votes the first time, couldn't they have just run it the first time?
I mean, I think that, right, that's what's up for debate. And they never actually put the negotiated agreement. So is it us that's negotiating in bad faith, or was it them? Because the bill that we, a compromise that we came to, was never even on the floor. So our members are going to oppose any bill that banned collective bargaining.
Okay, so you're saying they were opposing what was being voted on.
Yes, and what was on the Senate screen.
Right,
I mean,
okay.
Senate
so
floor.
Sub 3 was never adopted, is
yeah,
what
it was never
saying.
Adopted.
Okay. Angel, take me to your group. Just talk to me about why you support. Now we've gotten to the point where the law's passed, it's been signed by the governor, and there's a referendum effort, which means you guys are out gathering signatures, trying to put it on the ballot in 2026 so that voters might choose to repeal this law. Why is this important to you? Why is your group involved?
So I'm with AFSCME, and
explain what that is for our viewers.
So American Federation of State, County, City, Municipal Employees. Mm-hmm. And we're your public employees. We run things. And our jobs are not easy and they're often dangerous. And the union is our saving grace to keep us safe at our jobs. And without collective bargaining, I don't know that we would have the amazing employees that we have.
Yeah, explain the collective bargaining piece, because I think this is what the referendum gets down to, the heart of it, right? Should public employees, people whose taxpayer dollars we pay for their salaries, right, should they be able to get together and say, we want this salary, we want this for retirement, we want this for our safety negotiations, right? Is that something that taxpayer-funded employees should be able to do? That's at the heart of this, right?
Well, I'd like to answer that.
Yeah.
2 years ago, the county council wanted to not give us any pay raises while the cost of living was going up. Nothing at all. They actually wanted to charge us more for insurance, and it was a really bad deal. And in several of the departments, people just go to the public sector because they can and make more. And the union went and fought for everybody. Non-union, union, it didn't matter. They went and said, hey, you know, it's not as dire as you think. We could do this and this and reshuffle these things and people can still afford to pay their mortgage. And that's just one of the many things the union does for us. You know, I mean, with COVID, they were a lifesaver when I worked at Youth Services. The union is who... Well, that's going to be a story that's longer than the segment.
Gary, talk to me about your position. Why is it so important for collective bargaining for your groups?
So, and I think there's a misconception of what collective bargaining is. It's not like public employees are out there getting 10 and 15% wage increases every year. The majority of the collective bargaining we do with school districts is interest-based bargaining. So if there's a need that needs to be addressed within the school district, the unions work together with district leadership to determine how best to serve the staff and students. So the couple examples I can think of, when I was a local union rep at Granite School District, we negotiated taking less of a cost of living increase so that we could hire more custodial staff in our schools because there was a need for it. Uinta School District, they negotiated previously that they would take less money so that their special education paraprofessionals in classrooms could receive a higher wage increase than the rest of the union workers so that they were competitive to hiring someone that worked in the private sector in fast food or at a grocery store in Vernal. So I think there's a misconception of what is actually happening with collective bargaining. It's not that the union's coming to strong arm school districts or municipalities, but we're just trying to make a better public service for not only our members, but also for all of Utah.
I want to play you another clip from House Speaker Mike Schultz. This was earlier this week when he was at a legislative forum, and he defended House Bill 267, which is the one you all are trying to repeal. Let's take a listen to this clip.
We only had one city in the state of Utah with police and fire that did collective bargaining. The rest of them aren't affected. I don't believe that you have to be a member of the union to be treated fairly.
So he's saying that there's only one city, Salt Lake City, where their police and fire collectively bargain, and then the UEA. Those are the main groups who collectively bargain. But I'm hearing you guys shake your head at that.
I live in Mill Creek. I work for the county. The people who work for the county get collectively bargained for, I know, because my rep does it all the time.
So, Gary, why do you think he would say that?
I think there is a confusion of what UEA is and USEA, but we also negotiate six different contracts that are collectively bargaining contracts, but also we have meet and confer and negotiations with school districts that may be district policy, that we're trying to make district policy and procedures better. And even as we approach negotiations this year, now that House Bill 267 has passed, we talked with bill sponsors that those types of negotiations would still be allowed, but school districts are very concerned that they're not allowed, right? That we can't have those conversations. So I do think it's changed what we can and can't do, even if the intent of the bill sponsors weren't to prevent those types of negotiations.
So you've been out gathering signatures for about a week now. How many do we have?
So we're hoping to have a number within the next by the beginning of next week. Okay. There's a process, and they've made it very difficult for us. So we're looking at getting 8,000 signatures a day, but you have to verify those signatures before we can get a count. So we should be able to get back to you. I know that you're probably waiting for it as well.
Or we well, are. Well, I only check the Lieutenant Governor's website every morning at 9 a.m. Don't normal people do that?
Yeah, yeah. And I think that as it comes out, you can check protectutahworkers.com, and there'll be any announcements related to that there. You can also volunteer, make contributions to our campaign as well.
Give me your last pitch for why you believe people who maybe don't even realize what unions do in the state of Utah, why should they sign this referendum?
I mean, I think at the end of the day, House Bill 267 was not negotiated in good faith in the current form that we have. I think our hope with the referendum is that when we have enough signatures, that we can put it back in the hands of local communities, local elected officials, who deserve to have their voice heard. And that wasn't what happened with strong opposition for this bill.
How confident are you can get these signatures? Because 141,000 signatures in 30 days is a very heavy lift.
It's even heavier than that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they have stacked the deck against us.
Yeah.
They have the same 30 days that we have, that they're doing an active campaign on radio to try and get people not to sign. And then when we're done, they have 45 more days to actively try and get people to remove their names. So it's an unfair fight. But we're public sector workers, and we do the impossible all the time.
And I think you can talk about, we have 1,500 volunteers just through our protectutahworkers.com website. On Saturday at UEA headquarters, they had over 500 volunteers pick up packets. All of our regional offices ran out of packets as well. My staff was in the corner stuffing more materials on Saturday, and we're still doing that work. So there is overwhelming public support to get the signatures, and I'm absolutely certain we'll get it.
Very good. Angel Weiss with Salt Lake County, and then Greg Burrow, the executive director of the Utah School Employees Association. Thank you both for being here today.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Well, coming up, Governor Cox takes on top headlines in state politics. Hear where his head is as we move towards the deadline for him to issue vetoes. Stay with us.
You're listening to Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ehrens.
Well, Utah Governor Spencer Cox is speaking in favor of President Donald Trump's latest move to downsize the Department of Education. Now, on Monday, he penned an op-ed for the Washington Examiner saying it's time to wind the agency down. And he and the president agree that the department gets in the way of the state's ability to manage education on a local level. Now, Cox says that abolishing the department could benefit students in the long term and has support from governors on both sides of the aisle.
Two things. We can actually get more money to the states and save the federal government money, which we need to do. We're overspending as a federal government just by eliminating that and block granting those funds to the states. I can tell you that that is very popular on the right and the left when it comes to the governors in this country.
Well, the governor also addressed the reports that the Sundance Film Festival could leave over the state's upcoming classroom pride flag ban. He has yet to sign that, but we are waiting for that to be a possibility. Now, he cast doubt on the idea that the festival would leave for political reasons, saying that contradicted conversations he's had with the board. Cox said if they did leave, though, it'd be a big mistake.
I will just tell you right now that if Sundance leaves, that it will be a mistake, and that they will eventually wish that they had not left. I hope they stay. This is their heritage. This is who they are.
Now, one of the longest stretches of this week's press conference with Governor Cox centered on energy. Now, the governor is touting the state's work with its neighbors to expand the energy grid to power AI data centers and compete with companies like China. But he also took it as an opportunity to rail against environmental activists, he calls, who he claims harm their cause by refusing to recognize the continued need for fossil fuels.
The radical agenda of the extreme environmental movement, it has proven itself a failure. The people they claim to advocate for are the people that are suffering under the very policies that they are advocating for. It's an embarrassment, and I'm grateful that that elections have consequences.
Now, the governor here also reacting in part to a big win for the state in court. That same day, the state Supreme Court rejected a lawsuit from some Utah teenagers that argued that the state's reliance on fossil fuels put their right to a healthy future in jeopardy. Well, that does it today for Inside Utah Politics. Don't forget, if you have any local political stories you'd like to see, make sure to reach out. You can always find me on email. You can email insideutahpolitics@abc4.com. You can also follow along with me on social media. I'm on X, Blue Sky, Threads, Lindsay on Air. That's on Instagram as well. Just search for Lindsay Ayres, and Lindsay is spelled with an A. Also, our show is online in podcast form. Just search for Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ayres wherever you get your podcasts. Well, thanks for being with us, everyone. We will see you next week.